Hi there, it's Kojo Nandi. It's been 20 years since the events of September 11th, a day that has had rippling effects throughout our region for the past two decades. The WAMU newsroom put together a special report looking back at the events of that day, talking with the people who were at the Pentagon or living and working in the capital region. You'll hear from residents, politicians, journalists, first responders, the local Muslim community, and more about how 9/11 changed daily life in ways big and small. It's a powerful piece of journalism. I hope you'll take a listen to a WAMU special report, 20 years since 9/11.
This program contains vivid descriptions of the 9/11 attacks and the trauma, war, and violence that followed. Listener discretion is advised. This is a WAMU special report. 20 years since 9/11. I'm Esther Chamakili. If you listen regularly to WAMU, you might know the name Jeffrey James. He's my colleague. He hosts on Sunday mornings.
Five. Great. Good afternoon, everybody. Jeffrey James with you on a muggy...
But before he began his career in radio, Jeffrey had a different job.
I was an airline pilot.
Jeffrey lived in Southern California, but he was flying regional flights between Roanoke, Virginia, and Dulles International Airport. One September morning, after he finished his regional flights, it was time for him to head home to the West Coast. So he booked a ride on the next flight from Dulles to L.A. But then he heard from the airline. He had to do one more regional round trip before going home.
They were going to make me fly back to Roanoke and then back to Dulles. So naturally, I was in a funk.
It's early in the morning, he's tired, but he gets ready to fly this other plane back to Roanoke.
And as I'm doing the pre-flight checks on the flight deck, one of my colleagues came running on the plane and said, "Somebody crashed into the World Trade Center." The captain and I looked at each other and thought, that's kind of weird. It's a clear day. How is a Cessna? Because that's what we thought. Unfortunately, some private pilot lost their way and ran into the World Trade Center. So we turn on the radio and they didn't to say what had flown into the World Trade Center. They just said a plane. And we had actually finished unloading our passengers and were just about to close the door when the same colleague came running on the plane and said, "They did it again! What the heck is going on here?" And at that moment, ground control came on, all the radios on all the airlines that were at the gates, and said, "Everybody in the sound of my voice, deplane your passengers immediately. Deplane yourselves after you turn off your engines and disconnect your power supplies from your aircraft." Whoa.
Do you ever remember there being an announcement like that?
No, never.
20 years later, we know what was happening. It was September 11th, 2001. The planes that hit the Twin Towers were airliners hijacked in an act of terrorism. But at the time, Jeffrey only knew what he heard on his radio. He didn't know that the flight he had originally booked himself on that morning, American Airlines 77, had been hijacked too. At 9:37 that morning, it crashed into the Pentagon, killing 125 people in the building and all 64 people on board the plane. Less than half an hour later, another plane, thought to be headed toward the U.S. Capitol, crashed in Pennsylvania after passengers and crew fought back against the hijackers. Jeffrey didn't know how close he came to being on one of those planes until later that day when he got to a friend's apartment in Virginia.
When I got there and finally settled in front of the television is when I saw that they had finally identified that it was American Airlines Flight 77 that had gone into the Pentagon. And that's when I just kind of, everything on me kind of got electrically charged and my spine started tingling. Once the shock of me missing that experience wore off, I immediately felt a tremendous amount of gratitude that my company had made me miss that flight. I consider this the second chance at life.
For Jeffrey, and for many of us, the legacy of 9/11 lives on. In the days and weeks after, there were surges of patriotism, but along with that came a decades-long rise in xenophobia. The U.S. started a war in Afghanistan that ended in a chaotic exit last month. Security measures grew to prevent future attacks, but at what cost? 20 years later, we're still reckoning with the complicated story of 9/11. In this program, we bring you stories of that day, told by people who were here. We'll look at how it changed us in ways we can't miss and in ways we barely even notice. We'll hear how the Pentagon changed after the attack, how military contractors operating thousands of miles away reshaped Washington, the effects of racism and Islamophobia. And we'll look at our updated security state, asking, are we safer now? Let's start on that morning, Tuesday, September 11th, 2001.
That morning started with my dropping my husband off at work and then taking our four-year-old son over to daycare.
I work at a museum downtown on the National Mall, and I remember sitting in traffic on Washington Boulevard next to the Pentagon at about 8:30 in the morning, freaking out that I was late for work. Half an hour later, typical DC commute, I was at work and sitting in a staff meeting.
It was a gorgeous day, I think, as everybody remembers.
The sky was this, what I call Carolina blue.
I was working in a telecommunications network operations center. We monitor customers and make sure that their internet connections were up. It wasn't just one router in the New York area that went down. It was about four or five of them. So we said, oh, well, it looks like we have an issue in New York.
One of the other curators I work with came running in. She came running down to the front of the auditorium, and she looked very kind of panicked. And I first thought maybe she was running late. And so she grabbed my notebook and just wrote on the top of one of the pages, a plane hit the World Trade Center. I don't think at the time we certainly imagined it was a huge passenger jet.
How could any pilot not see that building? I thought an airplane accidentally ran into the building, and all of a sudden, boom, here comes number two. I said, uh-oh.
It's clear that this was probably a terrorist attack. You know, there were concerns about what was going on around the White House.
Someone had turned on the radio. It was usually on a news station, and so they just turned the volume all the way up. And so the only sound you could hear on the entire floor was this radio on my desk.
I remember hearing this really loud noise overhead, totally different from anything you'd ever hear. Went outside, a couple of the neighbors said they heard the same thing. One of the neighbors said that they saw the plane.
I rode the train into the Pentagon and went into the office, and I picked up a legal document that I was going to walk down the hallway. And as I was going out the door, something told me, don't go down that hallway. And so I turned the opposite way and I walked into the office for congressional liaisons, and they were watching TV, and I said, what are you doing? And they said, the Twin Tower got hit. I looked at them and I just said, there's gonna be a series of attacks across the United States and we're next. And it was just this incredible calmness that came over me. And I walked out of their office and I took one step into my office and the whole building shook. And I thought, this is it. We just got attacked.
That's Lieutenant Colonel Patty Horahoe. The plane had hit the west side of the Pentagon, breaking through three of the building's five rings of offices. For many of the people who were in the Pentagon when it was hit, the trauma of the attack took years to address. Eliza Thibault-Burkon has been talking to survivors from that day and brings us their stories.
Lieutenant Colonel Ted Anderson was on the phone at his cubicle when the plane hit. His wife at the time was a teacher. She called hoping he could explain to her sixth graders what was happening on television.
I said, this could be anything. It could be anyone. We need not jump to conclusions. No sooner than I finished that sentence, it felt like the entire foundation of the Pentagon came up off of the earth and slammed back down.
As the sound of the crash rang through the floor, Anderson yelled for his office mates to leave.
I heard people screaming, and they were coming down the steps as fast as they could, screaming, you know, there's fire behind us, there's fire behind us, get out, get out.
Near another corner of the building, Lieutenant Colonel Vincent Cam had just started leading a meeting. Cam and about a dozen people were in a third-floor conference room in the Pentagon's southwest corner, right near where the plane hit.
The lights in the conference room all completely just shut off. And there was a huge fireball that came at me right into the window.
Cam opened the door to dense black smoke pouring from the exterior ring of the building.
There's a distinct smell that I can never forget. This is the smell of burning jet fuel.
Cam and his colleagues evacuated. They moved slowly through the crowd of people trying to escape. Once outside, guards directed them across the south parking lot toward the Pentagon City Mall. Patty Horoho also rushed outside and made her way to the crash site.
There was just this gaping hole in the front of the Pentagon, and there was plane debris everywhere, and there was fire, and there was smoke, and it was this eerie silence.
Horoho was a trained trauma nurse. She'd assisted burn victims 7 years prior after a plane crash at Pope Air Force Base in North Carolina. She set up triage outside the Pentagon. Ted Anderson would soon bring victims there. When he heard the crash, he ran outside, where he met Staff Sergeant Chris Brayman, who worked as a cook at the Pentagon. They spotted a blown-out window on the ground floor. Anderson threw his suit jacket over it, and the two climbed inside. They crawled along the floor, struggling to see and breathe, shouting to any survivors.
To me, it sounded like every bit of the sounds and smells and emotions of combat. But yet here I'm on my own home front.
They pulled a woman from the building and ran back inside. Anderson saw a flash of light.
Chris screamed behind me, "Sir, help me, help me, help me. This guy's on fire." And we smothered the flames. He literally had run through a wall of fire to get out.
The man said others were trapped behind him. Brayman and Anderson helped him outside and then tried to go back, but firefighters stopped them. Moments later, a large section of the building collapsed near where the plane hit. Anderson says he still has guilt that he couldn't save more colleagues.
These people got left behind, and I just see it as a tragic failure, quite frankly.
Over the next 2 days, Chris Brayman went back into the building again and again. He was on a search and rescue team that trudged through water-filled hallways and twisted steel.
Days became minutes, minutes became hours, so I didn't know what day it was.
He had saved three colleagues on Tuesday, one of whom survived, and would recover the remains of 63 others.
My rule of thumb was they were never going to touch the ground again because they died with honor and they were going out with honor.
On the night of September 11th, Tisha Williams, an Army press specialist, could smell the smoke of the burning Pentagon from her Crystal City apartment. When she went to work the next evening, her first duty was to visit the crash site, a place she repeatedly guided reporters through in the coming weeks.
As you're walking down the hall towards the crash site, again, things that you won't forget, the smell, the smoke, the feeling of, you know, what had just occurred. Time stopped. The clock is on the wall, and you see the time in which, you know, just things just stopped.
The stress took a toll. Williams had headaches every day. Her hair fell out, but she felt like she couldn't talk about it at work.
There was this culture, you know, at the time that I didn't want to speak up. I didn't want to say, I feel sad every day. I didn't want anyone to think that I was weak. In comparison to all these other people who day in and day out were putting their life on the line.
But in the years that followed the attack, Williams watched attitudes change around mental health.
They recognized that if you get the treatment, perhaps that makes you a better soldier, better airman, better sailor, and so forth. And so folks are definitely encouraged to seek that treatment now.
Her colleagues have each had to deal with their own trauma over the last 20 years. After the attack, medical personnel at the Pentagon asked Chris Brayman to attend a group therapy session. There, people expressed regret that they hadn't done more to help others that day. And at first, it made Brayman angry.
I just let him have it. I go, how dare you? I go, you had the opportunity to help, but you chose to run. Every one of you in here are cowards.
That was 2001. Brayman says he has learned since then that people respond to danger in different ways, fight or flight. He has also learned about post-traumatic stress disorder, something he has struggled with over the past 2 decades. One thing that helps, he says, is talking to others about it. He does that a lot in a role he took on after 9/11, motivational speaker with the Department of Defense.
When I find soldiers and I see them with PTSD and I ask them questions, you know, when I'm out, I go, how are you doing? How are you fixing this? Oh, you know, I don't know. You know, they're all, I said, listen, it's either going to own you or you're going to own it.
Vincent Cam's office was just above the crash site. He says the attack inspired him to expand his efforts to help soldiers and veterans. He got licensed in acupuncture and helped establish an acupuncture clinic inside the Pentagon and raises money for wounded warriors. Cam says this helps him with his own healing process. Cam also has an annual tradition. Each year on September 11th, he visits the memorial built for the victims of the attack. 184 stainless steel and granite benches, each engraved with the name of a victim who was in the building or aboard Flight 77, rest above rectangular reflecting pools. Crepe myrtles offer shade to visitors.
The crowds might have thinned out a little bit more each year, but I can still see the same faces that I can recognize for this 20 years.
For others, the day is more solitary. When the anniversary arrives, Ted Anderson likes to be by himself. He says he learned over his 23-year military career to stow away trauma like what he experienced in 9/11.
I will take that luggage and put it up on its shelf, and I try to leave it there. Every once in a while, I'll smell something or hear something that reminds me of the event that day. I'll have to take it back off the shelf, and I'll have to deal with it a little bit, and then I put it back away.
That story comes to us from Eliza Thibault-Burcon. Outside of the Pentagon, confusion, fear, and caution were growing. A plume of dark smoke rose into the sky, and many wondered whether another attack might be on the way. Buildings emptied as workers tried to get home. Cars clogged the streets. Phone lines jammed as people tried to call loved ones. We return to recollections of that day from those who were there.
My name is Greg Carl, captain with the Arlington County Fire Department, and I've been with the department for 20 years. We went down to the Pentagon. It was just one of those things you just, no matter how you tried to process it, it was still like you were in disbelief that it happened. And one of the firefighters said, all right, it's time to go to work. Let's go.
I'm a transit worker, bus operator. I worked that whole day. So they shut the trains down and everybody was trying to catch a bus or something. The route that I had to take was from Union Station to Sibley Hospital. To make that one trip probably took about 5 hours. It was a scary feeling. People were acting, you know, real panicky. A lot of chatter going on, a lot of buzz about, you know, what's going to happen going forward.
It was just, I just remember confusion. I just remember the ambiguity of not really understanding what was going on and what did it mean and what was going to happen next.
I think the thing that stuck with me most was just, you know, this feeling that, you know, we were no longer as safe as we thought we were.
September 11th, I was the acting airport manager at Dulles International Airport. We have CCTV coverage, and they said, Paul, you want to see these folks that took down the airplanes? And sure enough, you could see them. They identified them with the little box, because you could take box cutters in those days.
Coming up, we'll hear how reactions to the attack took a hateful turn. I'm Esther Chamakili, and you're listening to a WAMU special report. This program contains vivid descriptions of the 9/11 attacks and the trauma, war, and violence that followed. Listener discretion is advised. This is a WAMU special report, 20 years since 9/11. I'm Esther Chamakili. For some Washingtonians, it was hard to predict the impact 9/11 would have on their personal lives beyond that day. For others, they knew their lives would be changed from the moment they heard the news.
I knew within hours of the attack that the history of the United States would forever be changed, and my life in this country would forever be changed. My name is Arjun Singh Sethi. I grew up in the DC, Northern Virginia area. And on 9/11, I was a student at Georgetown University and in Roslyn, Virginia. Being a sick American who can be readily identified by their articles of faith, you know, my long hair and beard, would I be a target? Would my Muslim friends and others be a target because of, you know, what had unfolded that day?
My name is Harnessa Faryad. I live in Sterling, Virginia. I grew up in New York City. I was in New York City that day, but in Queens. I was at home, 5 months pregnant with my second child. It was in that morning time I turned on the TV, and for some reason I thought there was a movie playing because I see one of the towers burning and in smoke. And I thought, oh, this is a really strange movie. And then pictures and names of all these hijackers came on, and my heart just sank even more because it went from not only mourning the lives that were lost and these people scrambling on the street and people throwing themselves out of the building, but it also went to, oh my God, they're Muslim. And I really didn't know whether I was allowed to mourn the loss of life or now I had to become on the defense of saying that they don't represent us. And that's when it took a toll that this is going to be an extremely difficult time for us in the United States.
My name is Arvin Amati. I grew up in Northern Virginia and I'm an author. So September 11th was my birthday and I turned 9 on that day in 2001. And so I didn't really have a sense of what was going on and how tragic it was. We celebrated that night, but we celebrated my birthday really quietly. We sang happy birthday really softly. My parents closed the curtains. It was a very sort of somber celebration. And at the time, I guess I was a little confused and accepted it. But then a few years later, I do remember realizing, oh, the reason that we were celebrating so quietly was because my parents wouldn't have wanted the neighbors to see the Muslims celebrating on 9/11.
Wrongly associating Muslim Americans and many others who either wore a turban, were Arab or Middle Eastern with 9/11 began almost immediately.
2 days after 9/11, I was in my car at Georgetown University and somebody jumped in front of it and yelled, "Go back home."
Despite calls from national leaders to reject bigotry, the FBI's number of reported hate crimes against Muslims spiked in 2001. And for every year after, they remained higher than they had been before 9/11. 4 days after 9/11, Balbir Singh Sodhi, a sick American businessman who owned several gas stations in Phoenix, Arizona, was shot to death in a spree of targeted racist shootings. The aggression ranged from violent hatred to everyday suspicion.
Even if people weren't directly taunting you or attacking you or being Islamophobic, they would still make comments because you were a representative of that area, of that region, of those people. So it'd be like, well, what do your parents think? What's the deal with Sharia law? What goes on in your religion? I mean, all these questions just feel super targeted.
And then we become the topic of conversation. It was really intimidating and really stressful. And a country that I felt safe in, that I felt that I could grow up, I went to school here, I had my kids here, that they could think that I was a threat because the people who committed the heinous act were from the same religion as me. What they didn't understand is that they hijacked our religion too.
I love America. I hate Osama bin Laden. I think I might have used one of my first curse words at him. I made it clear that Osama bin Laden was an that he could go off. And that was definitely one of the first times that I used those words. I had to make it clear as crystal that I was on this side, not that side. I was American. I wasn't with them. It came from the fear of being associated with those bad guys, those people that I did genuinely hate, but I hated them just as much for the terrible things they did and all the lives they took, the innocent lives that they took, as I did for how much more complicated they had made stuff for me and other people who looked like me in this country.
a lot of us women who wear hijab were conflicted with this idea of, do we stay true to ourselves and our faith, or do we take off the headscarf because we fear for our safety? A lot of my friends did, and that's fine, right? It's your personal choice whether you want to wear it or not to begin with. But I, for some reason, I stuck it through. Maybe it's my stubborn Afghan New Yorkness in me. But I didn't want someone else dictating what I can and can't do.
People, and especially kids, needed to draw these lines between the good guys and the bad guys, the heroes and the villains. I think every Muslim kid, every Middle Eastern kid became, you know, the bearer of that burden.
You just heard the voices of Sikh American activists Arjun Singh Sethi, Afghan American faith leader Harinesa Faryad, and Iranian American author Arvind Ahmadi. Today, we're remembering 9/11, its impact and legacy in the Washington region.
My name is Jason Vernia. I live in Arlington, Virginia. On the morning of 9/11, I was living in North Carolina in a friend's basement, working at a car dealership. By the time that I went to bed on the night of September 11th, I was committed to enlisting in the U.S. Armed Services. I was mid-20s and had only a high school education. And on September 11th, 2001, that seemed like a completely rational thing to do.
Jason enlisted in the U.S. Army in January 2002. And he found himself working alongside someone whose life also changed because of 9/11.
My name is Farid Habibzada. I moved to the United States late 2016, and I used to work as an interpreter for the American mentors and military in Afghanistan. We were training the Afghan army how to drive armored cars. And at some point, we were training them how to defuse mines and IEDs and an exploded ordnance.
Like Jason, Farid was drawn to his work with the U.S. military because he believed in its mission.
Interpreting is an interesting concept because when you're talking about Afghans and Americans, there are so many social and cultural subtleties that you're not actually translating words. You're translating cultures and ways of life. I loved it because I believed I was doing something good.
But the execution of that mission was flawed from the start.
I learned to question the leadership and the government of the United States in ways that would have been completely unthinkable to me had I not had the experience of seeing on the ground the results of decisions that were made by people far removed from the situation. It's only when one is able to gain an educated perspective, a historical perspective, a holistic perspective, or maybe even just hindsight, that it makes sense to question those moments and those decisions.
When it came to pushing back against the Taliban, there were gains made in Afghanistan.
It's really hard to imagine living under the Taliban regime until now, because it was darkness. But when you were inside it, like, you don't know it, because the propaganda machine was so strong.
But many, including Farid, view the U.S. departure from Afghanistan with mixed feelings.
America was an ally, but they just left in the middle of the night. That's a really bad message for the Afghan people.
The aftershocks of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan are personal for Farid and for Jason.
It still weighs heavy on me that one of my best friends in the whole world, an Afghan interpreter that was on my side for years, has a family that might not make it and it's because of a U.S. failure again.
The war in Afghanistan ended last month. As the Taliban retook the country, tens of thousands of Afghans were airlifted out. Many arrived in the U.S., landing at Dulles. The D.C. region is home to one of the largest Afghan-American populations in the country. Shakila Kalje, who now lives nearby, left Afghanistan during the Soviet invasion.
The invasion caused a lot of suffering and pain, loss of lives, killing of civilians, dumped in mass graves, millions dead, displaced, and exiled, and I'm one of them. I lost a brother who was murdered.
Since arriving here, she has been working as a journalist and activist, supporting her neighbors and supporting women in her home country.
I work with an NGO called Afghans for Tomorrow, which is basically an educational NGO we have in Afghanistan and teaching girls to go to school. And somehow I've always been involved helping and reaching out. I work as a liaison with the Fairfax County Public Schools with all the CIVs who have been coming since 2009, actually.
Kalje remembers watching the events of 9/11 and the aftermath in the U.S. and in Afghanistan.
I am an American, and it is the biggest tragedy our country experienced in recent history, and it was horrible. I remember the day, I remember the hour, we all do. I remember the feeling, the heat of the sun on my skin. I remember the sound. I just vividly remember it. Afghanistan was the hub of the terrorism and the person who launched that attack on America. And the Afghan people lived with the consequences and still paying the price for that. It caught Afghanistan in an invasion of a military coalition, which brought hope, fear, for a while, limited levels of stability, and very elusive peace interrupted by never-ending suicide bombing. But still, it brought a change. They created a new constitution. They had a brand new police force. All the trimmings and optics of nation-building was going right until it didn't.
Kalje says there was progress that followed.
What really stands out for me personally was that witnessing from close-up and personal the amazing, overwhelming enthusiasm, thirst, and hunger of women and young girls for being able to once again literally go outside and be visible and rejoin the society and being able to participate in their own lives. And they opened their clipped wings, if you will, and they progressed a lot. And there was they went to universities, they went to school, they graduated from school. It was unbelievable.
But that progress was constantly at threat of unraveling.
The attention went to Iraq war, and nation building turned into an unsustainable and costly military operation. And while Afghanistan became free of the oppressive regime of the Taliban, a lot of logistical, tactical mistakes were made that led to what happened few weeks ago.
Over the past few weeks, she felt like she's been watching the progress roll back. You mentioned to me when we spoke that you had friends and family members in Afghanistan that you were trying to get a hold of and trying to work on getting them out of the country. And I just wanted to know if you are comfortable sharing with us where you are in that process and if you've been able to actually contact your family members.
I do have family and relatives all over the country in Afghanistan. I don't want to name the areas and the locations, but one particularly is very distressed because she lost her husband and she has young daughters who are very young, and she does not know how to survive without a man, as the Taliban demands that you should have a man to chaperone you and all that. I read so many requests from women who are begging me and other Afghans who are here to help them get out of Afghanistan. It's almost a burdening sense of, I feel very burdened and very guilty that I can't do that, but we know we cannot do that. At the end of the day, a lot of Afghans and people are heartbroken and disappointed and incredibly feeling betrayed and angry, you know, even. I spoke to many friends who keep asking me, So what's going to happen now? What America is going to do now? And all I have to say is that we have to hope that they can, and then the international community keep the Taliban in check, to make sure that all the human rights and women's rights are being respected as much as is possible, that the world should not forget about humanitarian help, that we have millions displaced right now and they need food and shelter.
What do you think the future holds for women there in the country?
Afghan women are very strong. They're fighters. They don't need to be rescued, but rather respected in their own way. They need to go on their own terms and define their own sense of identity and feminism and place in the world. And they had that opportunity to do that for the past 20 years. Sometimes their participation in society was purely symbolic, but they took that, they grabbed it, and they went with it. So to preserve that is very important. And it's also very scary because we don't know how that's going to be possible. The Taliban are promising that they will let women live and do what they need to do within quote-unquote Islamic law. Based on the past experience, we know that is limiting. And it has nothing to do with Islam, but it has to do with their interpretation of how women should live. And so that's very concerning.
So you've worked with refugees for a long time, and Afghan refugees have started arriving at Dulles Airport. How is that effort to resettle them here in the Washington region going so far?
It is going well, but it's been a little bit chaotic at times. The overwhelming amount of people arriving here is creating a little bit of a backlog when it comes to being able to house them and take care of just the logistics of it. As far as donations and outreach of the community, it's been unbelievable. However, I think we have not been ready to receive so many people. When I say we, I don't mean only the Afghan community, but the agencies who are supposed to be involved in processing the refugees.
On 9/11, many Americans are inclined to reflect on the loss of those who died that day in New York, in Pennsylvania, in Virginia. But there are also, as you have been telling us, thousands of other lives lost overseas due to the resulting 20-year war in Afghanistan and 9-year war in Iraq. What do you hope Americans remember on this day?
I think for Americans, it is good to acknowledge the fact that blaming the Afghans is just a cop-out. You know, we have to take responsibility for what happened in Afghanistan after 9/11. And own what we did wrong and be rewarded for what we did right. You know, to be generous and patriotic, but to also be caring and understanding of the consequences of what happens when we go and invade a country. We can do that because we can help them without non-military interventions, with humanitarian projects, through building strong civil societies and through being partners and equals with the locals and nations and respect their culture, their language. These are the mistakes we made throughout the 20 years. We work with them from the place that they are and what they have, not what we expect them to be and do.
Coming up after the break, how the security industry changed where and how we live. I'm Esther Chamakili. You're listening to a WAMU special report. This program contains vivid descriptions of the 9/11 attacks and the trauma, war, and violence that followed. Listener discretion is advised. This is a WAMU special report, 20 years since 9/11. I'm Esther Chamakili. As the U.S. embarked on the war in Afghanistan and later in Iraq, it did so with a strong reliance on military contractors. Contractors provided everything from personnel to equipment, and the budget for their contracts more than doubled in the 20 years since 9/11, increasing by some $230 billion. As Matt Blitz and Jenny Gathright report, all that altered the very landscape of the region. And who can afford to live here?
When Dominic Molden looks down Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue in Anacostia, he sees a familiar pattern.
You see all those small black businesses, right? And you knew they were in danger, like 8th Street in the late 90s and the early 2000s. But now we know that all of that can disappear. Like when I see MLK Avenue, I know all of that can disappear now.
Molden has been organizing against gentrification and displacement in D.C. for decades. He remembers when there were rows of small Black businesses and vacant lots on U Street and H Street. But when wealthier white residents moved in the 2000s, longtime working class Black residents were priced out.
Always disinvestment and anti-Black behavior, right? I didn't know it. That's what it was. And we just knew that people didn't like us, people didn't like having poor people in D.C.
After that disinvestment came a cycle of investment, not in Black D.C., but instead in high-paying jobs connected to the federal government. And that accelerated after 9/11. Jeanette Chapman, the director of the Fuller Institute at George Mason University, analyzes economic trends in the D.C. area. She says 9/11 and the resulting war in Afghanistan accelerated the flow of federal dollars into the region. But the shift towards military contracting dates further back, to the Reagan administration.
There was pretty much an exponential rise between 1980 and really straight through to 2010. So the backdrop for September 11th was already in place for this dynamic.
2010 was the peak of defense spending in the D.C. area, when the wars in both Afghanistan and Iraq were at their heights. A significant portion of the spending centered on one particular area of the region, Northern Virginia. This had a lot to do with availability of land for offices and housing, but also the workforce that already lived there.
We do have a large number of highly educated, highly skilled workers.
In the 1990s, Tyson's Corner was nicknamed Internet Alley due to its abundance of tech companies. AOL was headquartered in Fairfax and Loudoun counties. So defense contractors like Northrop Grumman and General Dynamics realized that Northern Virginia was a perfect place to bring their headquarters after 9/11. Soon after, community planners and developers began to cater to this growing workforce. Cranes went up in Fairfax County to build high-rise apartment buildings. Arlington neighborhoods like Ballston, Roslyn, and Clarendon started to see more hip restaurants, luxurious gyms, and specialty retail.
Meals and entertainment and arts and recreation, all those things help add to the vibrancy of the community, which make it more attractive for private sector technology companies to come in.
That's Telly Tucker, the director of Arlington Economic Development. Tucker admits that this focus on building communities for a higher income, younger workforce leaves out others, like those who work in the service industry or even county police officers or firefighters. While the county is spending nearly $17 million on affordable housing initiatives next year, Tucker knows that may not solve the problem.
The natural impacts of supply and demand from a real estate market do price people out.
Dominic Molden says that at the same time the U.S. was funneling billions of dollars into wars, local governments were telling organizers like him that there wasn't enough money to subsidize housing or support small Black businesses.
When they say we don't have money to help people buy their homes, we don't have money to support the community-based retail, it's not true, right? So if you look at the military budget on the federal level, and when you look at the police budget on the local level, there's millions, hundreds of millions of dollars that are going into these resources, right?
Meanwhile, all that government contracting and defense spending in Virginia led new, wealthier residents to historically Black D.C. neighborhoods. It's something Derek Hira saw in the 2000s when researching his book, Race, Class, and Politics in the Cappuccino City.
I also talked with people who lived in Shaw U Street who were working out in Northern Virginia. They were reverse commuting, right? They wanted to be in D.C., but their jobs were out in Vienna.
Hira also teaches at American University, which holds WAMU's license. In many regions, funding earmarked by the local and federal government can contribute to gentrification, but the scale of the federal spending in the D.C. region made the changes here unique. Between 2005 and 2010, the Department of Homeland Security spent more than $37 billion on contracts in the D.C. region. That's more than 10 times what DHS spent on any other region. Contracts like those lead to new jobs, many of them with higher wages.
And I think we're going to see a new wave of gentrification that goes for the next 5 years.
That's WAMU's Jenny Gathright reporting with Matt Blitz.
9/11 changed so many things in our lives.
all of the construction of, you know, the barriers across the city and around the museums and the temporary barriers that become permanent. We're still not understanding historically the full effects of all of the changes that have happened.
I was the only person in security that night. I was the only person coming on that plane. And they stopped me and they searched me and they made me remove all of my captain's gear, uniform, and did a full search of me and my person. And unfortunately, my mom saw this and broke into tears, which was probably the hardest part. It was the increased security went way overboard.
I was pregnant with our son and we were looking at daycare centers. And there is a daycare center in a federal building next door to where I work. And we were having the conversation of, well, what if we have to evacuate the city again? What if there's another 9/11? What's going to be the safest thing for our baby, our toddler, our child?
After 9/11, security became a consideration for every facet of life in the D.C. region. There are special rules for flying into a Washington airport. There is additional security around important buildings. WAMU's Dominique Maria Benessi looks at some of those reforms and whether they've made us safer today.
To answer that question, you need to look at how security has evolved in the district. And to do that, we have to go back to the April 1995 Oklahoma City bombing, which killed 168 people.
Oklahoma City did indeed resemble Beirut after what police believe to be a 1,200-pound car bomb ripped through the nine-story federal building shortly after 9 o'clock this morning. More than 500
Then, just 4 years later, two students at Columbine High School in Colorado fatally shot 12 classmates and one teacher. These acts shocked and terrified the country. And politicians made a point to at least try to address what they saw as security failures. In 1999, a federal government commission released the first of several reports about ways to beef up security in public places in the 21st century. In D.C., experts recommended closing the stretch of Pennsylvania Avenue in front of the White House to vehicle traffic. Former D.C. Councilmember Jack Evans spoke with NPR's Morning Edition when the road was initially closed.
I think it's really a bad example of, once again, bowing to terrorism.
While some minor improvements were made, many were left to languish on a desk. There was no political will to actually implement any of the changes that would make people safer. A lot of the changes were either temporary or just added to the appearance of security. And besides, most people just didn't believe the threat at home was that serious. Frederick Nielsen has been in the security industry for over 30 years. He explained why the Columbine attack, in particular, is so horrifying to parents and law enforcement alike.
It was very difficult for the police to respond because they had very little information on what was going on inside of the school.
Nielsen is currently the vice president of Axis Communications, one of the top three earning video surveillance companies in the world. In 1995, Axis developed the world's first network-based security camera. Today, K-12 schools are the top buyers of Axis surveillance systems. Back in early 2001, the fledgling company was still trying to grow in the U.S., and it was only 3 weeks before 9/11 that Nielsen and his wife moved to the U.S. from Sweden.
The day before 9/11, my boxes from Sweden just arrived. So I was standing in the living room unpacking those boxes as we saw the events of 9/11 unfold on TV. And I was actually starting to pack up the boxes again. I said, I'm going to go back. I'm not going to stay in this country here. This is crazy.
Former D.C. Mayor Anthony Williams says the district was in chaos the morning of the attack. Pennsylvania Avenue, East Street, and 15th Streets all closed to traffic. The pulse of Washington came to a screeching halt. William says no one was prepared for an attack of this magnitude.
Originally, there was talk of just closing more streets that are already closed to regular traffic around the Capitol complex.
So immediately after the attack, big changes were made. In addition to road closures, police and military officers patrolled the district, and armored vehicles lined the streets. But the city and the federal government struck a deal not to close Constitution and Independence Avenues to traffic. Williams says as the city looked to reopen in the days after the attack, they had to strike a balance with various federal agencies' security concerns.
There's a give and a take with all these institutions on making this balance. And from the city's point of view, minimizing disruption to pedestrians and auto traffic.
In the weeks after the attacks, the federal government and major corporations invested billions of dollars to permanently beef up security systems, especially around the nation's capital. Having unpacked from his move, Nielsen decided not to move back to Sweden and began to see an opportunity for his company.
This would be an opportunity to actually do make a difference with this new technology. There would be heightened awareness and interest in security video surveillance, and we thought we had this great idea to actually provide a lot more value to the systems for both law enforcement and private company.
Today, hundreds of Nielsen's cameras, similar to those that were installed in so many schools after Columbine, can be seen around the National Mall. And over the past 20 years, the cameras have gotten better at distinguishing things like light, color, and even faces. They've also gotten smaller. You might not even know they're there.
You know, the white van with people in the back of the van. I'm sorry to ruin your perception and, you know, watching detective movies. But today, that's a parked car somewhere that looks like an ordinary car, and there's cameras around the fenders, and you can place it in certain spaces and do video surveillance there and move it around.
Counterterrorism measures didn't stop at road closures and high-tech cameras. An entirely new way of gathering intelligence was also constructed.
Some of the major things that happened were the establishment of the Department of Homeland Security.
That's Audrey Kurth Cronin. She teaches counterterrorism at the School of International Service at American University, WAMU's license holder. After the attacks, the DHS building sprung up across from AU on Nebraska Avenue Northwest in 2003. Cronin says it was one of the numerous recommendations that didn't go anywhere before 9/11. As the DHS began its operations, colleges and universities in the region started looking into where threats really came from. George Washington, American, and George Mason universities began offering programs in counterterrorism through a global lens.
There was a huge flood after 9/11 of academics and intelligence folks and government people of every stripe. Every area focused much more on terrorism afterwards.
With all these advanced security measures, Cronin says we are safer from another attack by an international terrorist group. But we are still less safe from attacks within our borders. That's because
there were far too many resources that were put toward one type of terrorism, and those resources were withdrawn from U.S. domestic terrorism. And we have to fix that now.
The FBI called the insurrection on the U.S. Capitol earlier this year domestic terrorism. But unlike previous domestic or international attacks, the nation couldn't agree on what happened, let alone how to respond.
So are we safer? No, we're not safer because we ourselves have lost track of what we should be focusing on.
That's WAMU's Dominique Maria Benessi reporting. As more time passes after 9/11, our thoughts change. We learn more about ourselves, our experiences, and how we cope. And while some people have found closure in their experiences from that day, others are still reflecting 20 years later.
It is going to be a difficult day. That content is hard. We still cry after all these years. The trauma is still very near to the surface for a lot of people. And I think knowing that you did not have to be in New York or in Shanksville or at the Pentagon to have a deep emotional experience of that day and to still have it. I think it's important to acknowledge that.
You have generations of Americans who are now teenagers who don't remember it or who were not alive when it happened. And so our obligation as the nation's history museum is to help people look at the event itself and then start to ask questions.
9/11 was a tragic day in the history of America and the world. But what followed was also tragic. The hate violence that so many communities experienced, the increased militarization and surveillance that Muslims, Sikhs, and others experienced, and the excessive use of force and militarization abroad to respond to the attacks was also a mistake.
I just always kept hoping that the greater good would eventually emerge, because there are hundreds and thousands of American men and women working with hundreds of thousands of non-American men and women to make things better. And it's the patience that is required for all those little tiny efforts to build up that we don't seem to have.
This special comes from the newsroom at WAMU. Gabe Bullard, Ruth Tam, and Patrick Fort produced this hour. Additional editorial help comes from Rachel Sidone and Letty Holman, and additional interviews recorded by WAMU's Jordan Pascal, Natalie Delgadillo, Rachel Sidone, Margaret Barthel, Elliot Williams, Kelsey Proud, and Ayan Sheikh. Mana Kashfi is the station's chief content officer, and Erica Pulley Hayes is WAMU's general manager. We heard from dozens of people about their experiences on September 11th and in the months and years after. Thank you to each and every one of you for telling your story. This would not have been possible without you.
I'm Jennifer Jones.
I'm Dan Baltz.
Hi, I'm Kira Schuster.
Hi, my name is Mike Scheinberg.
Yeah, I'm Paul Melandrino.
Yeah, I'm Eric Parker.
Hello, everyone. My name is Quincy Jones.
Hi, I'm Shannon Parrish.
I'm Esther Chamakili. Thanks for listening.